Welcome, one and all. This is Robert Rogers, and you have just connected to Parkinson's Recovery. I am on the shores of the Puget Sound, where I must say we are enjoying the first totally gorgeous day of the spring. It is a beautiful world indeed. In my last edition of Road to Recovery from Parkinson's Disease, I actually wrote a section, this would have been back a year ago, about a connection between Candida and Parkinson's disease. And I must confess, I was a bit reticent to actually keep that as in a component of the book, because no one else really out there in the universe, to my knowledge, had really identified such a connection. After the book came out, I actually received some correspondence from several readers who said, oh, by the way, I just found an article that says exactly what you were speculating about, somebody who, in a scientific way, shows that there is, in fact, a logical and scientific and medical reason why there is a profound and direct connection between Candida, which basically is a yeast infection in the body, and the symptoms of Parkinson's. Well, I'm delighted and pleased and excited today to be able to tell everyone that my guest is the author, or one of the co-authors, of that article, Lydia Epp, who has an absolutely, hold on to your seats, incredible story to tell about how she came to the conclusion that Candida was playing a role in the particular neurological symptoms that she happened to be experiencing, as well as her former husband and her current husband. So it's an incredible story. Lydia, thank you so much for being with us on the show today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, your story started back a while ago, and as I understand it, the origins concern Parkinson's symptoms that were being experienced by your ex or former husband some years ago.
Yes, yes. I think I need to start, from the beginning, probably would be a good point. I got married to my ex-husband in 1990, and it was probably about a year later I started to experience some issues with my health that I haven't experienced ever before, and there was, of course, at that point there was absolutely no connection to anything. I just started to notice strange new things about my health popping up here and there. And let me tell you a little bit about those symptoms as they, as those health issues, as they later, it became obvious they are part of my larger story. But about a year into our marriage, I noticed that I developed some skin issues. And I actually went to see a dermatologist about it, and he told me that basically I, these are just age spots, which was kind of strange because I was 30. And maybe it's connected with me taking oral contraceptives, and I shouldn't worry too much about it. And a lot of women have similar problems, and it's nothing of concern. And so basically he brushed me off. I noticed these were kind of freckle-like spots, but they were regular. And another new and strange thing that happened to me around the same time, I stopped tanning. I used to tan easily. I am kind of an outdoorsy person, and I spend a lot of time outdoors. And I noticed that I'm not tanning anymore. No matter how many hours I spend outside playing tennis or walking or doing whatever in a garden, I don't tan. And on the top of that, I got those dark blotches on my skin. So that was my first symptoms. Then a year later, I developed several so-called seasonal allergies. And these allergies were ranging from stuffy nose and sneezing and watery eyes to really debilitating severe headaches during especially early spring when the pollen season starts. And I never had that before. I was, like I said, an outdoorsy person. And I never had any problems with allergies. And suddenly I was taking different nasal sprays and allergy Claritin, whatever was available at the time, which really didn't alleviate my problems. So, basically I was again told that I have to just resign to the fact that I started to... sometimes later in life we can develop seasonal allergies, and it's nothing that unusual about it. Well, so I took my Nasonex and Claritin, and I walk around with watery eyes and sneezing 20 times at a time and thinking that, well, that's just the way life's going to be for me. Then I developed, it might not be necessarily in the exact time frame as I'm telling you all those different symptoms, but they kind of crept up one at a time. I noticed that my back was hurting me more often. I never had problems with back before, and suddenly I was experiencing pains in my lower and mid back. I went to see a chiropractor, and he told me I developed some mild to moderate spurs in my vertebrae. And of course, chiropractor helped me some, but not that much, and I had to suffer through those bouts of pain that would go away, but not exactly, and then I had them again. So that was several of those symptoms that were completely seemingly not connected with one another. And I think it was mid to upper 90s, 96, 97, when my ex-husband noticed some very disturbing symptoms in himself. And eventually, long story short, he went to see our family physician, and he sent him immediately to see a neurologist. And a neurologist diagnose him eventually with early onset of Parkinson's disease. That was, he was at the time, if I'm doing my math correctly, 43. At that time, I'm telling you all those things as they happened, but back then I did not connect them. Of course, there was absolutely no connection between my seasonal allergies with my ex-husband's diagnosis for Parkinson's disease. I did not know at that point that they were in any way related. And so, what would you like me to say next? About maybe my ex-husband's Parkinson's a little bit more, or more on my side of the story?
Well, I'm sure people would just be interested to know what the next chapter was. So there was you with your issues, and there was him with his issues. We're on the edge of our seats. So what happened next?
Okay. He was, like I said, he was in his mid-early 40s, and he was very active, like me. We were avid tennis players, runners, and... he tried to continue with his active lifestyle, but it was increasingly difficult because his Parkinson's was progressing really rapidly. I'm sorry, I'm not going to give you that many details about my ex-husband since I don't have any contact with him anymore, and I really don't have his permission to talk too much about, you know, to talk about his health condition back then, but I believe that it was a part of my life as well. So in that context, I'm sure he won't mind sharing some details of his struggle with his health. His Parkinson's was not very responsive to initial treatment, and forgive me, but I do not remember exactly what was the original therapy, but I believe they initially they put him on levodopa, And it took quite a bit of time and the medication to see some kind of noticeable improvement in his condition. And then around the same time, I think he got in touch with a renowned neurologist, neuropathologist in a big university in the state where we used to live, and we were delighted to finally have a national authority on the subject to see him. It was really very promising. And that was the doctor that first prescribed him Mirapex. I know that there is much more awareness of that drug nowadays. Back then, it was still experimental drug, and I believe he enrolled as a part of a clinical trial. And there was absolutely nothing known about the side effects of the Mirapex. And my ex-husband didn't respond like his doctor would have hoped for. Actually, all of his Parkinson's drugs kind of help, but not really. So they help to some degree. But the disease was progressing quite rapidly, and no matter what the dosage of his medication he took, there was still some symptoms remaining. So the doctor was really disappointed in the degree of improvement, of relief that my ex-husband was getting from all those drugs. Mirapex seemed to work the best, but at very, large doses. And as I'm sure your listeners, at least some of them, are aware, and if they are not, maybe they should look into it, Mirapex has severe side effects. And these are mostly psychological, psychiatric side effects. The obsessive-compulsive disorder kicks in, irrational behavior, aggression. You can go online and read about it. There is a wealth of information about it right now. Unfortunately for me and for my ex-husband, he had really severe reaction. He had a lot of the side effects present because of his therapy with Mirapex, and our life took turn for much worse. He became, I should say, his personality changed drastically, and our marriage was on the rocks because of that, and I seeked help from professionals, medical professionals, psychologists, psychiatrists, neurologists. I tried to contact the neurologist originally prescribed the Mirapex, and basically he brushed me off. He was not aware of any side effects, and he basically told me, well, just enjoy the life that you have and don't worry about it. Yes, well, maybe his personality changed somewhat. Wouldn't your personality change if you would have been diagnosed with Parkinson's? And I suppose there's a grain of truth to it, so I said, okay, well, I will take the good with the bad. But things gotten progressively to the point where my ex-husband decided that he wants out of marriage, and we promptly got a divorce because of, his new and uncontrollable obsessive-compulsive symptoms. It became really a relief for me to get away from the relationship that was no longer what we used to have. He, at this time, was on heavy doses of Mirapex. I believe he was taking levodopa, and his Parkinson's was still progressing rapidly. So I moved out to another state, to another town, got a different job, and lost touch with him. In the meantime, from common friends, I've heard stories that his Parkinson's is still, it's progressing. And because of his profession, he is also a geneticist. And it became almost impossible for him to perform his duties because of the shaking of Parkinson's. And so his life did not look good for him, as far as I could tell from a little information that I had that our friends told me about him. So in the meantime, now I'm skipping a few years. I met my, it sounds terrible, my current husband. His name is Bob, so he gave me permission.
Ah, good name.
So his name is Bob. And a few years later, we got married. And we would have lived happily ever after. However, after about a year of marriage, our marriage, Bob noticed that he suddenly became allergic to pollen. He developed back pain. He developed severe migraines. He developed severe skin rashes. And then we paused and we said, you know what? This is not a coincidence. It cannot be. Actually, I have to praise Bob, who by profession is a pilot. But he spent days and nights relentlessly looking through the information, mostly on the internet, to find how is it possible, what possibly could be mildly contagious disease that would cause those symptoms, and it would take years to develop. And he was the first one, I think it was 3 o'clock in the morning, when he woke me up and he says, I found it.
That's great. He woke you up then.
he was on the internet. I just could not persuade him to you know, take a break and slow down. He was on a mission that he's going to find what is going on. At this point, we knew something is going on. It's not a coincidence that we both previously very healthy, middle-aged people suddenly develop the same health issues. And it happened to me before when I married my ex-husband. Now Bob is married to me, and a year later he developed the same symptoms. It cannot be.
What symptoms were you experiencing at the time when he woke you up at 3 o'clock in the morning and said, aha,
I
figured it out?
Let me just tell you, I was a mess. I was, if you look on Candida, chronic candidiasis symptoms, and it's a long list of them, I would say I had 80% of them. I was fatigued. I was depressed. I had severe skin rashes. I had a constant problem with my GI upset. I had severe migraines. My migraines were absolutely debilitating at this point. It could go on for 3 days. I was unable, you know, that kind of migraine that you can't look at the light, you cannot hear any sounds because it hurts. Then I also, I had a surgery for my back because my back was a mess. I had problems with my the spurs in my vertebrae, and I also developed a herniated and then eventually ruptured disc because candida does weaken your cartilage. Now I know. I didn't know it back then. My gosh, I had a myriad, just really 80% of that very long list of candida symptoms, I had them all. And Bob's first symptoms, especially the one that bothered him the most, was rashes. He had severe skin problems after like maybe half a year to a year after we met. So anyway, so it became obvious that there is a common denominator to all of that. And finally, Bob found it. He didn't know much about it. He says, look, there are some scientific papers. I don't know all that stuff. Why don't you read it? But I think that's the thing that we both have. So that was when I started to dig into it, and sure enough, as the more I read, and that was in early 200s, 2001, 2003, I want to say, yes, 2003. Back then, there was really not that much information about chronic candidiasis online, and I have to say there is a lot of bad information online. There is some very good information, and there is some very bad. Just because somebody posted it online doesn't make it so, and people post the strangest things, and if you come unprepared and you start reading indiscriminately, you can wind up with some strange websites and strange advice. So I just my word of caution to whoever is going to do any research online on that issue. I believe things change, and now there is much more legitimate research published online. But back then, it was people trying to sell you all kinds of strange herbal remedies, and the real solid information was really scarce. But after doing that research, I realized that, yes, indeed, Bob is right. This is the candida that we are experiencing. And my first question was, how do we get rid of it? And so that led me to Dr. Orion Truss, who was a physician. I don't know if he's around anymore. He was a gentleman in his 80s when I... met him, because I just called and I asked if I can fly to Birmingham, Alabama, to be his patient, because I'm that desperate, and so is my husband, and he is the authority on the subject, and is there any chance that he can see us? And he said yes. And so next thing I know, I was on the plane to Birmingham, Alabama, to see Dr. Truss, and he was, I believe, 82 at the time, which was mid 2003, and he was still practicing, and that is his specialty. That's all he did. His practice was treating patients with chronic candidiasis. And it was such a relief, because he was the first person that I could talk to, and he didn't tell me that I am hypochondriac, that there's nothing wrong with me, that I should just take some over-the-counter Claritin and everything is going to be fine. I forgot to mention, I was diagnosed with something called aspecific environmental asthma, which basically meant that, well, you have something that looks like asthma, but we don't know what it is, and we don't know where it came from. And it was shortness of breath, a kind of heavy feeling in my chest, and a persistent dry cough. I went to see my family physician about it. You know, I will back up a little bit, if you don't mind. I hope I'm not confusing anybody, but I will back up a little bit. Before I saw Dr. Truss, I tried, since we figured out that it was a candida, we decided that we're going to try our luck with our family physician. And I went to see, actually, both Bob and I, we made an appointment to see our family physician together. And when we went there, we told her the story. She looked at us like we're from another planet. And basically she told us, well, there is no such a thing like chronic candidiasis. And we said, well, but that's what we believe we have. And she answered us, well, you know, when I was in medical school, they didn't teach us about chronic candidiasis that would attack your entire body, basically, different tissues. And she was extremely skeptical. She thought we are one of those strange people who believe that they read something online and suddenly they know something about medicine and they think they are almost professional. And also, I think she she decided that we both are kind of hypochondriac. We talk ourselves into being sick to some kind of mysterious disease that doesn't exist. And at that point, I went to see a ear, throat, and nose specialist, and then they told me I have this non-specific environmental asthma and gave me an inhaler that didn't help. My doctor decided that for my other problems, maybe I have some kind of bacterial infection, and prescribed me broad-spectrum antibiotics that didn't help. However, there is this thing. If you are on a broad-spectrum antibiotic, especially those most recent ones, they do have a component that is anti-inflammatory. So candida does cause a lot of inflammation inside in your respiratory tract, in your GI tract. So if you're taking antibiotic that has that component, it actually helps. So I felt somewhat better. And as soon as I stopped taking antibiotic, I would go back to where I was and actually got worse. And the same thing repeated itself with the inhaler. Inhaler constricts your vessels, blood vessels in your respiratory tract. So it did help some during the time that I was taking it, but as soon as I stopped taking it, it didn't help at all. So you can experience some relief from the symptoms because of those anti-inflammatory components in those drugs, but that doesn't mean that the drug is the one that you should be taking. And that's exactly what happened to me with one antibiotic after another and one inhaler after another. I was really going downhill very fast. My back pain was just unbearable. My migraines were just horrible. I had 2-3 days of every week being completely incapacitated because of my migraine. So that's when I decided to see Dr. Truss, and it was like, really, I couldn't believe. He was finishing my sentences for me. When he asked me what are my symptoms, how I'm feeling, he would literally finish my sentences for me, and it was such a relief. Finally, I'm sitting at doctor's office, and here is a medical professional who knows what I'm talking about, who doesn't think I'm crazy, who doesn't think I'm just talking myself to being sick, who knows my symptoms, and in the end, he tells me that he can help me. So that's how I started taking nystatin, and it's an antifungal drug that is very safe. I don't know if you want me to tell you the story what nystatin is, but it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think lots of people would want to hear that. It's an antifungal drug?
Yes, it's an antifungal drug, and it's actually very safe. It's actually given to infants for oral thrush. And it has absolutely no side effects. If you take too much of it, you might get nauseous, but that's the only thing. It is called antibiotic, because what antibiotic means, it's antibiotic. So this is bacteria that kills the fungi. It was discovered, why it's nystatin, and why. It's because it was discovered by researchers, microbiologists in, I believe, 1935 or somewhere around that time in New York State. They were looking at farms, and there were farms where cows would have fungal disease, and so they couldn't take milk from those cows. And then there was one farm in New York State that cows did not any fungal diseases. And so they were taking microbiology streaking plates for microbiology from those cows. What is the microorganism that those cows have on the skin that prevents them from having a fungal infection? And that was a bacterium that basically it eats fungus. Like, I mean, it's one organism kills the other one. And so nystatin is the purified powder form of that bacterium. And that's what it does. It feeds on yeast. And it is, I don't know, maybe they developed something better since I took nystatin, but that was the best medication that you can have for candida. Now, it has to be in powder form. Oftentimes for infants, they give it in solution, and they put tons of sugar in it, and sugar is the last thing you want to eat when you have a candida. So Dr. Truss, I didn't know back then, but he told me the only form of nystatin that would work was that pure powdered form, and you just mix it up with a little bit of water and drink it. It, believe me, it tastes horrible, but I wanted to drink it all day. As soon as I
Now, who makes this? Where do you get this?
It was a compounding pharmacy in Birmingham, Alabama, that I bought it from. It has to be written by prescription. And here is the thing. If you take a nystatin, but you don't follow the whole regimen, then don't bother. Because it's the whole different way of life that you and there is no shortcuts. You have to do it, and nystatin is just one. It's a very important segment of that therapy, but it's not the whole thing. So please don't get an impression that if I just find somebody who can prescribe me this nystatin, I'll be fine. It is only a portion of the story, and I'll get to the rest of the story in just a moment, but we did follow the regimen that Dr. Truss recommended, and there is his book. It's called Missing Diagnosis by Dr. Orion Truss, and you can buy it on Amazon, I think. This is the best book that I've seen. Dr. Truss is one of those physicians that you wish all physicians would be like him. He is very professional. He is very extremely knowledgeable on the subject. He really researched the issue, and he is actually the first one that named and first diagnosed the symptoms, the chronic candidiasis. The name comes from him. He was a practicing physician in the hospital, and he noticed some patients that had symptoms, which now are known as chronic polycystemic candidiasis. Back then, they were just patients that wouldn't respond well to anything, and they would keep coming back to see him. And eventually, he was the first one that made the connection. He wrote a couple books about it. Recently, he wrote Missing Diagnosis 2, and I haven't read that one yet. Of course, I don't need it now, but I would like to read it. I just didn't have a chance yet. He wrote a number of articles published in the 80s, I believe, on the subject. The first one, I have it here with his autograph, actually, Metabolic Abnormalities in Patients with Chronic Candidiasis, the Acetaldehyde Hypothesis. And, when it was published. It doesn't matter. I think it was 1983. He published several articles on the subject. So the long story short, I saw a dramatic improvement in myself, and Bob recovered very quickly as well, because it turns out that we caught it very early. Before we didn't have those symptoms for many, many years. We didn't have that much damage done to our bodies. so we were able, and we were still relatively young in our early 40s, we were able to recover quickly. And we were absolutely religious about the regime that has to be followed to really fully recover. And so after, I believe, half a year, I was basically symptoms free. I had my life back, which is absolutely amazing. You don't know how bad you feel until you start feeling better again. And then you look back and you realize how many things you gave up on doing, how limited your life became because of the debilitating condition that took over your life. And then I realized how significant it was and how significant the improvement was. And so I looked back and I said, well, okay, there is still that connection. My condition started after I met my ex-husband. And then I start to experience more and more symptoms. And then I passed them on to Bob, to my current husband, who never had any contact with my ex-husband. So it has to be a mildly contagious condition that originated with my ex-husband. So then I started to think about it, and I realized that basically he also had so many symptoms of chronic candidiasis. He had terrible problems with his GI. I think at some point in life, he was diagnosed by one of the physicians with irritable bowel syndrome. He constantly was popping Tums and Rolaids, and he had really he was sweating a lot, and he had always skin problems. He had fungal skin diseases that he constantly was fighting and was unable to fight because they would just keep coming back. He had a toenail fungus all his life. And so then I started to think about all those things, and I said, well, okay, so we established that he had a chronic polycystic candidiasis, and I got it from him. And it is a mildly contagious disease. And sharing a towel, sharing the same bed, rubbing your skin off in sheets of the same bed, using the same kitchen utensils, spoons, you know, it can be casual contact over a period of time. It will cause the same this effect. So then I started to think about it, and I said, well, is it possible that the candida was a reason why he developed Parkinson's? Would that be a part of the equation? Because there was no family history in his family of Parkinson's. He was in his early 40s. Average age of onset of Parkinson's is it 67, or it might be even higher?
Oh, I think it's a little younger than that because more and more young people are beginning to develop symptoms, so maybe 60 or thereabouts.
Oh, really? So it went down because I believe that time it was mid-60s, mid-upper 60s.
Yeah, now I think it is getting lower and lower, and many, you know, teenagers and people in their 20s are developing the symptoms. So.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's another argument to my theory.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, so then I started to look at it, and I did discover a connection, which brings me right to my biochemical aspect of it. But if you want to ask me more about my general story of my candida, I don't want to jump to the next subject. subject.
Right, because we've got the scientific part that we want to be sure and cover as well,
right.
Following up on your particular article. I think some people may still be a bit stumped about exactly where Candida comes from. So you've explained that there you can actually be exposed to it from casual contact, but it's also something that you can get from eating foods. Is not that right?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, so it's basically a live yeast.
Right, exactly. My source of my problems with Candida was from contact with my ex-husband. But you can develop the problem all on your own. And it's basically it's any combination of several factors, and it could be long-term use of broad-spectrum antibiotics. I've seen a lot of articles online talking about people when they're teenagers, they develop acne, and doctors treat them with, I believe it's tetracycline, for a very long time, low doses of tetracycline to keep the acne at bay. That is apparently a perfect recipe for just wiping out your healthy gut flora and replacing it with Candida. Now, don't get me wrong. Candida is present in a healthy person's GI tract. It is needed. Actually, we need Candida albicans as a part of our intestinal flora. So it's not that evil entity that invades us. It's just the balance of the percentage of how much of that Candida is a part of your gut flora. That is the question. Because if you have a broad-spectrum long-term antibiotics, that basically kills all the bacteria because antibiotics are fungi. And so they kill the bacteria. That's the other side of the nystatin story. So what is left is the fungi that will not be killed off by antibiotics. And then Candida, basically, it's kind of filling out the vacuum principle. If there is nothing left in your stomach but the Candida, then it will take over eventually. So if you take broad-spectrum antibiotic, it's a really huge predisposing factor. Now, I'm getting into some medical stuff, and I just want to make sure that you and your listeners understand that I'm not a medical professional. This is my story, and this is my opinion. This is what I think. By no means I am giving any medical advice to anybody. I can give my advice what me, Lydia Epp, would do if I would be in that situation again. But this is not a medical opinion. I am not a medical professional. But these are conclusions that I came to by dealing with the problems myself.
So exposure to antibiotics and casual contact with somebody who has it, and also ingesting certain foods
exactly.
With yeast.
You know, I believe that we are all part of nature, and nature likes balance. And if we don't have a balanced diet, it can cause, bad things happening with our body. And I really believe that. But I don't know which one comes first, chicken or the egg. Is it a Candida that causes you to crave certain foods and keep your diet off balance? Or you keep your diet off balance, so then Candida is more likely to grow. Because if you eat a lot of refined carbohydrates, if you eat a lot of sugar, flour, simple carbohydrates, this is what Candida needs to, that's food for Candida, basically, to put it simply. So, once Candida starts growing, it depletes your body of sugars. So then you crave them more. And you really don't crave them for yourself, but rather for the invading organism that depletes your body from a normal balance of those. Because you do need some carbohydrates. Should be part of your healthy diet. But if Candida utilizes all of it, metabolizes it, itself, then your body craves that. And if your body craves, you eat more, and then you feed more candida, so candida grows really quickly. And so it's a vicious cycle. So, yes, diet is a very important component, but does it come as a result of your candida problem, or you develop candida problem because of your diet? I am not sure. But it is.
And the candida are not... The candida are not just residing in the GI tract. As I understand it, they float all over the body and create problems, as you were just describing earlier.
Well, yes, that is my understanding. I believe that's what happens, but don't tell that to any traditional medicine GI specialist, because he will laugh.
I'm sure.
They do not believe in such a thing. But, yes, I believe that it starts in your GI, and then it spreads out throughout the tissue. Really, I think I had a candida in my lungs. That's why I had a hard time breathing. I never had that before. I never had it again. But during that time when I had really severe candida infection, I could hardly breathe. It was like somebody pushed on my chest with fist and prevent me from breathing in. It's that kind of feeling. And I never had that before. I never had it again. So I believe I had candida growing somewhere in my respiratory tract. I do believe it.
Several years ago, I aired a radio show where I did talk about candida, and I had a passion for going on a candida-restricted diet and, you know, taking some other treatments to resolve candida issues I had. And the curiosity for me was, ever since I'd been a child, I'd had these spots. I thought they were freckles on my arms. They're pretty dark, and they were all over the place, and I just thought I was a pretty speckly guy. When I went through the treatment protocol, I began to notice after just a week or two that the spots were beginning to dissolve, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at my arms right now, and they're pretty freckle-free. I mean, I don't have any freckles there at all. So what is that?
Any...
I mean, what are those dark spots anyway?
Yeah, no, exactly. I don't have any dark blotches on my skin anymore. Now, interestingly enough, my ex-husband always had those they were kind of freckle-like freckles, but not so round and pronounced as regular freckles are. But these were basically darker blotches on the skin. Yes, he had it. And it never, for me, it was very characteristic when it comes to skin. It is that I stopped tanning. I think candida utilizes pigments from your skin. So you lose ability to tan during summer. And me being person that spends a lot of time outdoors, I noticed that in the end of the summer, I used to be dark. And I know skin cancer, but I didn't care much for that. All the SPS, and I said, oh, well, if I burn, then, you know, so be it. But I was not tan at the end of the summer. That is another little piece of my theory, that candida takes away pigments from skin. So if you notice that back when you were younger or some few years back, you did tan and now you cannot, it's another, piece of evidence that it could be the case, that you have something... that invades your skin, that prevents skin from natural process of tanning, which requires pigment. Another thing that is very important, candida is, if you have such a severe infection, because if you're experiencing all those symptoms, the infection is severe. And it's chronic, but it's a severe infection. And it is a fungal infection. Your body is trying to fight it off, and that's why I developed, and many people I know, they do too, develop those allergies, because your autoimmune system is just out of control, doesn't know what to do with this. And then you develop food allergies, chemical allergies. You can become allergic to smells. the scents, and there are some women that became allergic to their perfumes. So your immune system is just say, okay, I'm on overload. I just don't know what to do, so I'm going to react to everything, or I'm not going to react to anything. And that is so true with when it comes to the fungal diseases. So people that have candida often develop other fungal diseases because the immune system just gives up on fungal antigens and say, okay, I guess these are just parts of my skin. This is part of my body now. So I have to allow them to exist. And people with candida infections will have toenail fungus, ringworm, Tinea corporis. There is a lot of different fungal conditions that are secondary to that. And that basically is a result of your body's lack of defense against fungal organisms in general. So I had a really bad case of ringworm that I promptly gave to my husband. So there is a lot of those different components that come into play, and when you start following that trail, it just all falls in place, and it's like, oh, wow, I have this, and I have that. Oh, yes, that's right. I didn't know it was connected, but suddenly it's like a big puzzle that you suddenly look at it, and you see a big picture, when before it was just little pieces that you would never put together as a part of the same issue.
You have explained quite eloquently the causes of candida in the body and also explained the use of this antibiotic powder, which was a treatment that was actually prescribed by Dr. Truss, but also mentioned that was part of the treatment. What else did you have to do in order to rid yourself of this overabundance of candida in your body as well as Bob's body?
Right. Again, I would refer to the missing diagnosis, Dr. Truss' book. He has it spell it out in detail, but in general, basically you don't eat carbohydrates. You starve candida because that's what candida needs to metabolize to in order to multiply, to live. This is a food that it will utilize that, it needs in order to keep invading your tissues. So if you starve the organism by not ingesting anything that candida can metabolize to support its life cycle, then you starve it to death. And then whatever is not killed off by the lack of food, you kill it off with the antifungal medication. And it is a very, very rigorous prescription for candida cure. But it believe me, I don't know how I can stress it more. You cannot cheat. You cannot say, well, I'm just going to have this donut today, and then I will go back on my diet tomorrow. I suppose it works, if you try just to lose some weight. But if you are on anti-candida regimen, you absolutely cannot do that. It is like starting all over again. So it is really a draconian diet, but it works. And you have to commit yourself 100%. My gosh, 150%. You cannot say, today I'm going to take it easy on myself. I'm going to put some sugar in my coffee. I really, really like that pizza place, so I'm just going to have one slice. You cannot do that. And it requires great deal of knowledge. So I really had to sit down and educate myself. There are books that you can buy them online, and it became sort of my Bible. I walk around with this until I learn everything. It's a big book with lists of all the food items, and it has the carbohydrate and sugar content, and of course calories and whatever else. But what you need to focus on is carbohydrate and sugars. And you have to stay on about 50 to 60 milligrams a day. Believe me, it's nothing. It's 1 teaspoon of sugar. That's it. It's really hard, and you would not believe where carbohydrates are hidden. Do you know how much sugar is in the spaghetti sauce?
A lot, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
A lot, I think, isn't it?
Yes, it is. There are food that you would never think that has high carbohydrate content. They do. You have to read every label of every food item that you're going to eat, and you have to basically walk around with a calculator, and if by lunch you exceeded your or you are at your maximum for the day, then you just stick with, salad, and it can be tomatoes have a lot of sugar. Carrots have a lot of sugar, so not every vegetable will work. I have to tell you, it's a wonderful diet. I lost 20 pounds. Actually, I lost more than I wanted, that I should have. I was pretty skinny at the end of a diet, and I stayed on that diet for 2 years. But you learn do's and don'ts. You learn what you can eat and what you cannot. And it becomes easier. First few months, it's terrible. And also you have the die-off phenomenon where the candida starts to die off, and you feel terrible. You actually feel sick. You can even run fever. And I did for a few days. I felt like I have a flu. And that is... it's probably not very kind of good way to appealing way to put it, but if you have flowers sitting in the vase and they start to die, they give out all kinds of smells and odors and gases, and basically that's what candida does. When it starts to die off, it gives out all those toxins, and it you feel sick. Because suddenly the living organism that used to invade you is dying out. And for some people, I heard it can take up to 2 weeks. For me, it was maybe 3 or 4 days. I felt terrible. But if you stick with this diet through that period of time, after a few weeks, suddenly there is a dramatic improvement. And that was very encouraging to me because the diet is so draconian.
But you did stick with this, it sounds like, for 2 years. So you were in it for the long haul.
Well, I hate to say it, but it is not a quick fix. You cannot do the candida diet for a week and next Monday wake up and be healthy. There is no quick fixes there. There is no easy and miracle pill that you take and everything is good, or you stay on the diet for a short period of time and you wake up a couple weeks from now and you're feeling great. It is a long haul, but it can be done. Let me tell you, I'm enjoying my dark chocolate. I'm enjoying, I enjoy pizza occasionally. So I'm not on a diet anymore at all. Now, it did teach me how to eat wiser. When I go to the grocery store, I still shop looking at the labels. I don't buy food that are high in refined sugars, refined carbohydrates. I do eat much healthier as a result of that, but I think it's good. And it really has nothing to do with candida anymore, but I just feel much better. And if you stay on that candida diet, eventually you can go up on carbohydrates up to, 100 milligrams a day or something. So after a few months, you can ease your body in back into some of that. And if you feel relapse, if you start to feel sluggish, you feel bloated, you start to feel symptoms of candida again, then you have to back up, of course. But first several months, it's very strict, and there is no quick answers how to, you know, get rid of it really fast. At least I'm not.
If you'd like to ask Lydia Epp a question, you can call toll-free right now. This is a live program, and that toll-free number is 877-590-0733, or you can connect through your computer using Skype. In 2006, Lydia, you published an article titled Chronic Polycystemic Candidiasis is a Possible Contributor to Onset Idiopathic Parkinson's Disease. Tell everybody about your discoveries that you convey in that published article.
Yes. I contacted my ex-husband. Oh, I guess I didn't go to that part of the story. I contacted my ex-husband, and I told him about my findings, that I believe it was candida, and I also believe that there is a connection between the candida and the Parkinson's. And I will tell you this story in just a second, but I will just tell you this about my ex-husband. He immediately, because like I said, he's a geneticist, he immediately, he listened to me carefully, and he says, you're right. You're absolutely right. I think you just figured out how to help me out with my Parkinson's. And at that time, he was, from what he told me, he was not working professionally anymore. He was unable to do that. He had the deep brain stimulation, which didn't really work. Didn't give him the results that everybody was telling him that he would experience. And he was having really rough time with the Parkinson's, that was really devastating him. He went to see Dr. Truss as well. And apparently, from what I was told by my old friends who run into my ex-husband, said that it was astonishing. It was such a dramatic improvement. She called me and she says, I could not believe my eyes. What a remarkable improvement it was. And, of course, she asked him what happened, and he told her that I contacted him with my theory, that he followed through, and there he is. I don't know how is he doing now, but I understand a few years ago I received some information from another friend of mine. She says that he's doing great. And it is my understanding that he, just like me and Bob, stayed on a very strict anti-candida diet. He took the nystatin, or he was Dr. Truss's patient, so whatever was the Dr. Truss's therapy for him, he followed that. He no longer needed the deep brain stimulation, and I have to tell you, he told me that a little story, and I hope he doesn't mind that I will share that with you, because I think it really is a good one. He went to the hospital. It was University Hospital that they had the deep brain stimulator implanted. And I understand, as I understand the procedure, you have like a remote control, a switch that you can turn it on and off. And they were doing some tests and asked him to turn it on first, and then they will go through some mobility tests. How is he doing? And he followed through their directions, and they did the test on his mobility, and they said, oh, well, you are doing great. You see, there is a significant improvement. Then he said, well, I have a surprise for you. I didn't turn it on. It was off.
That's a funny
and
story.
And they got mad at him.
Oh, I bet,
they say, what did you do that for? It messes up our statistics.
Right.
And he says, well, aren't you excited? I am much better, and I can tell you, if you ask me, I can tell you why I'm better. I found the reason why I found the cause of my Parkinson's, and I'm curing it right now. Don't you want to know? But they didn't even listen. They were so busy looking at the monitor and being so concerned about how that's going to throw off all the statistics on their
messed
research.
Up the data set. Yeah, right.
Yes.
Yeah. How do you correct that then? That's really
quite funny indeed. Excited about his miracle
right.
improvement. They were excited. I mean, they were concerned about, how could it be that he didn't turn it on and now they put it in the wrong column and how it's going to look.
Right.
So my understanding is that he got much better and he was on his way to, I don't know whether it's a full recovery. I have a feeling he had it for so many years and there was so much damage done to his central nervous system, but it's just my guess that he will not be able to fully recover his motor ability. So he will probably still have some stiffness, maybe some pain. I don't know. I haven't heard from him. But it was my understanding last time I talked to him, I believe it was 4 years ago, that he is doing remarkably better. And
so this is the Parkinson's. This is the Parkinson's Recovery Radio Network, and so that's a wonderful story of recovery of an individual who clearly was experiencing some challenging symptoms. So he got better, you got better, and just to be clear, Bob also, as I understand it, as well. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. He was very early in the whole vicious cycle, so he recovered first, actually. And then it took me a little longer to get to the point where I'm back to normal. But I'm absolutely back to where I was before, and if I wouldn't have my scar from my back surgery, you would never know I had any health problems. I don't have any allergies. I don't know what migraines are. We live out in the country, and so when the allergy season starts, this is just as bad as it gets, but I don't have any allergies. I don't even ever take Benadryl anymore. I spend a lot of time outdoors, and I do tan. I have no skin problems. Quite frankly, I am a very healthy, middle-aged person right now. I take no medicine of any kind, and I am not on any diet other than I am watching my diet because I know that carbohydrates are not such a good thing for you to eat in excess. And I just don't like them. I don't like the sweet taste anymore because I'm not used to sugar anymore. And I don't want to teach myself again to be used to that. So I'm doing great, and Bob is fine. And as far as I can tell, my ex-husband is doing much better.
Tell us more about what you've discovered then from a scientific
yes.
and medical point of view about the connection between candidiasis and the symptoms of Parkinson's disease.
Yes, well, medical point, I cannot tell you because, like I said, I'm not a medical professional, but I will tell you from scientific point of view the best I understand. Since I contacted my ex-husband and he noticed this dramatic improvement, I realized that I was right and there is a strong connection. So then I started to think, well, so what does Candida do in your body when it metabolizes? What are the product of its metabolism? And it will be one of the things that it gives out in huge amounts, acetaldehyde, which is a form of alcohol. And that's why oftentimes people that have Candida kind of feel like they had a glass of wine. Because that's basically the same mechanism. And acetaldehyde, it converts dopamine into something called felsolinol. And I am not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. I don't know what is really the correct way to pronounce it, so I apologize for me sounding a little funny. But felsolinol is a selective neurotoxin, and what it does, it triggers apoptosis of dopaminergic neurons. Apoptosis is a fancy name for programmed cell death. Cells are kind of like little computers of sorts, and they have all kinds of programs running to multiply, replicate, grow, whatever. And also, they have a program called apoptosis. When it's time to die, they engage into that program, which basically it's a cascade of biochemical processes that basically tells a cell to, well, start dying. And the salsolinol, is a compound, it's a chemical that will trigger that apoptosis signal in dopaminergic dopaminergic neurons. So it's not that it will cause any A cell to die. It specifically targets neurons that are associated with dopamine, dopamine receptors. So there is a vicious cycle, basically, and if you look at it, it's a very straightforward, actually, chain reaction. And there are reports in scientific papers that salsolinol is increased in the presence, the level of salsolinol is increased in spinal fluid of people with Parkinson's disease, and it also is present in urine of PD patients. So there is evidence that that is indeed the chain of events. And then I started to look for papers on the subject, and to my astonishment, I didn't find any. Nobody wrote about it. And I was just completely puzzled. Why? And maybe I'm missing something. After all, I don't work in neuropathology, so what do I know? Then I started to write emails to whoever wants to listen to me, and that was mostly scientists that work in the field of Parkinson's pathology. And eventually, after knocking on a lot of different doors and people basically not being very receptive to my theory, who am I and why am I interested in that? And I'm sorry, what is your name again? Oh, ex-husband, I see. And finally, I wrote to Dr. Boris Mravets in Slovakia. He is a distinguished professor there of immunopathology and endocrinology. And I wrote, and at that point I didn't care anymore, so I just wrote him an email and I explained it to him in, fairly scientific terms, I hope. And but I told him the whole story, and that included my ex-husband's story. And I didn't really expect to hear from him. I thought it will be another one of those, my failed attempts to have somebody get interested in the subject. Next day, I got an email from Dr. Mravets. He says, I wish I would still have that email because I had to read it 5 times until it finally sank in. He says, you have a groundbreaking theory. You are absolutely correct. It is my assessment that your theory is absolutely correct. Would you like to write a paper? And it took me, like I said, 5 times to read the email until I realized, oh my gosh, he believes me. And that's how it all started. And we emailed back and forth. Basically, I wrote the article. His English is, well, sometimes not very fluent. So I wrote an article. He corrected a few things from the, factual point of view. And we got it published in his university because I didn't have any funds for publishing anything. And since this is just a theoretical paper, this is not any kind of case study, and there is no experiments to support our theory. So it's basically a call for papers. If somebody is interested out there, they can take it and run with it. I think it's a valid theory. However, at that point, when I wrote that paper, I thought that was the connection. Now I look back and I know that it is one of the many connections. The whole process, the biochemical interaction between candida metabolites and dopamine receptors and the symptoms of Parkinson's, it is a very complex, multi-level biochemical process. And I have further thoughts on how this biochemical processes take place. It is something called tissue transglutaminase, and it's a very hot topic now in the field of neuropathology. There is a very straightforward connection between tissue transglutaminase and celiac disease, which is now connected or implicated in the onset of the candida is implicated in the onset of celiac disease. And tissue transglutaminase is identified as the autoantigen in celiac disease, which people didn't know about that before. And tissue transglutaminase catalyzes the formation of alpha-synuclein crosslinks in Parkinson's disease. So there is, I don't know if you are familiar with, and I'm sorry, I apologize for my pronunciation, Levi bodies. It's alpha-synuclein aggregates in the brain of people with Parkinson's disease. And it's catalyzed by tissue transglutaminase. So there is another very straightforward biochemical pathway that links candida with celiac disease, with chronic candidiasis, and with Parkinson's. So I think the process is very complex, and what I found out is just a little tip of an iceberg, and the iceberg is still underwater, but it's all connected. That's what I believe at this point.
So transglutaminase, or TTG, is basically something that plays a role in candida's life cycle. Is that right?
Well, yes. It is, and I have here, it is C. albicans, its function, candida albicans function, it stimulates the antibody formation against tissue transglutaminase, TTG. So it causes, as a result, it causes inflammation in the guts, and the inflammation in guts caused by candida. Okay? And then it causes your body to start producing the tissue transglutaminase. And tissue transglutaminase, in turn, it induces, it catalyzes the formation of the they call it Levi bodies. It's a hallmark of Parkinson's disease in the brain. So it basically causes dopamine receptors to die and form those aggregates in the substantia nigra. So the candida starts the cascade that ends with, well, of course, the acetaldehyde from my previous paper, but it also, one of the things that it does, it induces your body to start producing tissue transglutaminase, which is also associated, and that there's a lot of papers on that, with the tissue injury. Well, your lining of your intestine is injured in a way by candida albicans because it actually adheres to the intestine walls. So it starts a cascade of events, and this is just another biochemical pathway of the same process, which is very complex, and I'm sure I don't understand it fully. I don't think anybody understands it fully yet, and there is really no papers linking all of that together. There are papers on celiac disease and Candida albicans. There are papers on tissue transglutaminase and cross-links with Parkinson's disease. There is identification of tissue transglutaminase, alloantigen, in celiac disease. But all those dots, nobody connected them yet and published it. And I actually contacted Dr. Moravitz, but he says this is really out of his field of expertise, and I need to find somebody who specializes in tissue transglutaminase to see if my theory is correct, and I did. And that professor whom I contacted, he specializes in tissue transglutaminase as it relates to pathology of neuropathology of Parkinson's disease. And he was very excited after I explained him that possible connection. And actually, he was excited to the point that he says, hey, I have some money left over from one of my grants. Why don't I run a small study on the rat model and see if I can generate some data to get a grant to study just that, which is fantastic. It's more than I hoped for. And he says, well, you know, what would really help our cause if we have a case study. I said, you know what, let me contact somebody. I might have a case study for you, a patient, Parkinson's patient, that actually is geneticist and understand everything that we're talking about right now, and I'm sure he will be willing to participate as a case study. And so the professor says, well, that's fantastic. So who is it? I said, well, it is my ex-husband. And that was the last time I heard from the guy. And the word ex-husband closes all the doors. And it is true. It was my ex-husband. I cannot deny it. But the theory has nothing to do who was it and what relationship I have with that person. It is still, I believe, a valid theory. And I think I got something there. But, you know, what can I do?
So it would be nice to find some collaborators, some people who are willing to take this to the lab and do some rat studies and, you know, carry that further and do some case studies, it sounds like.
Yeah. But, you know, this is really not my field. I am a molecular biologist, but I don't specialize in that field. This is totally out of my area of expertise. I can read a paper and understand it, but this is not what I do for a living.
I know. Right.
I would love to hand it over to somebody who knows more on the subject of neuropathology of Parkinson's and who has the money and energy and interest in doing this. That would be fantastic because I believe there is something there, but, I don't know, maybe I'm mistaken, but the fact that my ex-husband, myself and my husband, Bob, we are all doing better. I think that's a proof in itself that maybe my theory was the correct one.
Yes, indeed. It does sound like that's the case, that you do have some case study evidence in its own right. I had a conversation with an individual about a year or so ago, and the conversation went like this. I have a terrible fungus on my foot that's been between my toes for now several years. Do you think that has any connection to the neurological symptoms I'm currently experiencing? I think what you're suggesting is, the answer is yes, there is a connection. Am I summarizing that correctly?
Yes, it could be a connection. It could be that your immune system just doesn't recognize fungal organisms as an invading, as an antigen, something that they need to fight. It needs to fight. Because you have the fungal organism, it is different, but it's still a fungal organism. It's constantly present in your body, and your immune system say, "Oh, it's one of those guys. It's okay." You see, you basically do not have normal immune response to fungal diseases. So I do know that, and there are publications that people with candida or people with Parkinson's have problems with fungal diseases like skin conditions, toenail fungus. And look, I'm not saying that all the Parkinson's cases are induced by candida, but by no means. I'm saying that I don't know what percentage of Parkinson's cases are connected with candida. I believe that candida is a very potent component of the picture, and it produces neurotoxin, and if on top of that you have other predisposing factors, you will develop Parkinson's eventually. But Parkinson's could be, I think it's a name for a symptom, and the causes of those symptoms can be different. It could be a traumatic head injury. What is that? Muhammad Ali? I believe his story is completely different, and it's completely unrelated to candida. I have to tell you, another predisposing factor that my ex-husband had was, in my mind, that's my take on it, he was a long-distance runner, so he wanted to stay lean and not gain weight, especially when he was training for a race or whatever. He liked his tea really sweet, so he didn't want to put sugar in it. He put aspartame in huge quantities, and I don't know if I can say it on your radio, but I will say it.
Well, of course you can.
I believe that aspartame is a very potent neurotoxin. It is just the worst thing that you can put in your mouth. It is documented that it is selective neurotoxin, and the amount of aspartame that he took was huge. He, like I said, he liked his tea really sweet, and he liked 2 or 3 teas a day. So he took huge quantities of whatever, the NutraSweet or, yeah. So there was another predisposing factor to his Parkinson's. But, yes, I believe that fungal candida infection is a huge predisposing factor to Parkinson's. But it might not be enough to trigger the onset of PD. Maybe there is other. Maybe you need another factors that will favor the development of PD, that will, the straw that breaks the camel. In my ex-husband's case, that was the aspartame. But it could be different things for different people. For instance, farmers that are exposed to pesticides in huge quantities, that could be a very large contributing factor. So I think it's different for different people. Our bodies are different. Our weak points are in different places. So PD is just the kind of very general description of symptoms that can be caused by any number of things. But going back to your question, yes, I think that a chronic infection with candida does lower immune response to other fungal conditions, like skin conditions. So it probably is associated.
Lydia F., this has been a most fascinating discussion for me. I've been on the edge of my seat the entire hour and a half. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to tell us your story and being a guest on the Parkinson's Recovery Radio Network.
Oh, you're welcome. It was my pleasure, and I hope listeners took some information from it and they found it useful.
And it is indeed a groundbreaking revelation and it encourages anyone and everyone who suspects that they may have a Candida issue to investigate that much more seriously and aggressively. Given the story that there are three individuals whose health has returned completely and totally, that's a motivation in itself to be able to know much more about the devastating effects that Candida can have on your health and wellness. For those of you that are looking for further information about Candida, I do have information in the revision of Road to Recovery from Parkinson's Disease. You can get that if you visit Amazon, or you can see more information about the second edition of Road to Recovery from Parkinson's Disease by visiting parkinsonsdisease.me. And that's what's happening on the shores of the Puget Sound, where all the women are smart, all the men are handsome, and all the children are truly loved. Know that you are on the road to recovery by virtue of the fact you're listening to this show. Have a marvelous week.